This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Jessica Lynn's experiences as a transgender woman and parent led her to dedicate her life to spreading awareness and acceptance for gender non-conforming communities around the world.
You know, it's not just 1, 2, 5 people that are changing the world. We all of us, every single one of us, need to continue the conversation to change the world.
GLT's Mary Cullen talks with Lynn ahead of her ISU Speaker Series visit tomorrow night. Eric Stock talks to local advocates for sexual assault survivors about the Why I Didn't Report movement. Plus, Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner recaps last night's city council meeting. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. Thanks for choosing this GLT podcast. While it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Take a moment and make a contribution to help pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org, and thanks. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Bloomington aldermen have approved a tougher stance on landlords who repeatedly violate the city's housing laws, plus new incentives for a packaging company moving into Bloomington. The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after the regular and special council meetings. Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for joining us again on Sound Ideas.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
The new policies approved last night by aldermen are expected to give the city's administrative court more power to fight landlords who play the system to put off fixing violations and avoid paying fines. Also singles out chronic properties with more than one violation in a single year for a stricter reinspection schedule. So what do you think of these changes?
I think these are long overdue. And this is part of our broader movement over the past 4 or 5 years or so toward trying to really clamp down for public safety and, frankly, for economic development on so-called deadbeat landlords or people who are just letting may not be landlords, they're just letting their properties deteriorate. And that's not helpful or safety for them or for others in the neighborhood. And certainly I had an old house about 10 years ago, and there was an abandoned house kind of diagonally from me, and that made it very difficult to sell that property when I was trying to sell it. So there are lots of other, there are lots of reasons for why this is a good policy. The administrative court itself began in 2015. Before that, we would have filed cases in the circuit court, and we had only filed one in a decade. The previous decade before that, before 2013. So clearly, the word on the street that, you know, you can get away with anything in Bloomington may have been overstated, but not by much. We certainly had very frustrated police officers. I can tell you, they took me on many tours of our own city and showed situations where you had unsafe properties, and they would write them up. They would send it to legal would send it to code enforcement, and not much would happen other than a slap on the wrist letter. And so now we haul them into administrative court. And even within that administrative court, we're fine-tuning that so that we can, frankly, make sure that our community is as safe as possible and that the economic investment that people put into their homes reaches its full potential.
As part of that fine-tuning, now offending property owners who ignore compliance orders will now have to pay $110 in court costs, even if that problem is addressed before the court date. Those failing to abate will face a minimum per violation fine on top of those court costs. So last night at the council meeting, Alderman Scott Black said he wanted to go even further, be more aggressive. He still supported it. It was a unanimous vote. Did you want to go further, too, at all? Did you
Absolutely.
Have any? So how much more aggressive would you have gone?
I'd want to be. Well, again, it depends on the particular policy. I don't know about, the dollar amounts are still comparatively small. And we would have to be careful about people. Let's say maybe if you've just purchased a particular property and there are code violations on that property, that's a different story if somebody's rehabbing a home as opposed to someone who's a perpetual violator. So we would have to fine tune our ordinance to be sure that we're, in a sense, going after the right people. And we don't want to go after historic preservationists. We want to go after the people who are, frankly, slumlords in many cases. And I think that we've had a great deal of success, but we have much more to do. And this is all part also of neighborhood preservation. If we really are serious about our comp plans, our comprehensive plans attempt to infill, then we have to have strong neighborhoods inside of Bloomington. Our older neighborhoods have got to be stronger and more attractive and safer for investments. If you don't, you know, if you don't have any confidence that your neighbor three doors down's house that's falling apart is ever going to get fixed, then you may just move, or you may decide not to fix up your property.
Was there a concern that these changes may inadvertently reduce access to low-income housing? You push a few landlords out, maybe they sit vacant for a while or get torn down. Is that a concern at all for you?
Obviously, any affordable housing generally is a very serious concern for me, but we're moving in many other ways too, and through the Bloomington Housing Authority to try to increase the number, you know, the number of units that are affordable housing, and in economic incentives, trying to deal with potential developers for affordable housing in our community. It is a serious problem, but that doesn't mean we don't crack down on offenders. So we can do both.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner, Alderman also approved last night around $75,000 in economic incentives to help commercial packaging move into their new spot, a building on Ireland Grove Road, helping cover the cost to remove a water tower that had kind of become derelict, also offering a discount on connecting their driveway to the street out there. So what do you think of that proposal?
I think it's a very important proposal. It's important for economic redevelopment in that area, in the Wildwood area, and it's not just that particular facility, but it is, you know, that's important. And it's certainly important for public safety as well as aesthetics to get rid of this old water tower. And we also have clawback provisions. So we protected taxpayers, we protected the city. And that is, if for some reason the people don't, or the business does not live up to their responsibility, then there's that clawback for any monies that we might have rebated in terms of future revenues, future taxes. Let's be clear, this is not money that we currently have in our budget. This is based on their future investment and future revenues. And so if we can begin to change a very underperforming area and turn it into something where people are starting to invest, capital investment will attract more capital investment. And that's the case in whether it's neighborhoods or whether it's commercial development.
Well, there were some concerns from a couple of aldermen. Karen Schmidt and Johnny Painter voted against it. I think it was a 7-2 vote. Alderman Schmidt said she worried that the decision would change the city's approach to economic development to kind of a case-by-case basis instead of some sort of solid policy that's available to all. It kind of speaks to there's always that tension in economic development,
right,
versus case-by-case versus something that's kind of standard boilerplate. So what did you think of the concerns you heard from them last night?
I think it underscores the reason why Alderman Black last week said we needed to go back and look at our economic development policy that was developed well over 7 years ago, almost 8 years ago. It is dated. We need to make it clear what we will do and the kinds of things that we won't do. But we do have, almost everything has to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis within a certain framework, because different businesses are going to need and want different things depending on what they're doing. This is not just a business that's moving in. This is a business that could easily move in and just leave this rotting water tower sitting there. We have, I think, a public interest, and they in an interest in that coincides with their private interest to get rid of that water tower.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner, last week Alderman got an update on Grossinger Motors Arena. The arena reported a loss of $665,000 for the fiscal year that ended a couple of months ago. Second year that Venue Works has been in charge since taking over from Central Illinois Arena Management. So the bigger headline, though, out of that meeting was that Venue Works told Alderman essentially that the city should expect an average of $500,000 annual loss moving forward on the arena. So what did you think about what you heard last Monday night about the arena and its financial state?
Right. Well, there was nothing there that was terribly surprising, and I certainly appreciate their honesty. I also appreciate their transparency and openness in many ways compared to the previous managers of the Coliseum, of course. But I don't think $500,000 personally is acceptable. I think we need to come up with additional strategies, and perhaps we work with Venue Works, or when their contract is up, maybe we choose a different company. But these are the kind of calculations that we have to make. We also need to consider the fact that the arena, this is only the cost side of the ledger. The arena Grossinger Arena, used to be called Coliseum, whatever, also brings economic benefits to the community. And we need to consider those as well. So we need to consider the entire picture as we move forward. But in terms of the operating cost, I'm not happy with a continued $500,000 deficit in the operating cost of the Coliseum. I think we can do better. I think we have to try to do better. Now, there are many who say close the Coliseum or whatever. Well, we have the Coliseum. We own it. We're going to pay over, $2 million a year on its mortgage no matter what we do. And we do not need another building that's rotting in downtown Bloomington. So we're not abandoning the Coliseum. We need to make it work, and we need to move forward. And so I think those are things that the council is unanimous on, and I think pretty much any economic development professional that's in the entire business would encourage us to move in that direction. Now, if in the end of the day it turns out that, after 5 or 10 years of experience, we find that, hey, we're going to have to live with this $500,000 deficit, okay, we will have tried, but we've got to try.
Hmm. Well, you said nothing you heard there was especially surprising, but it did seem to get the attention of at least a few aldermen and those who want to be aldermen. Amelia Burgess called it sobering, said that all options should be on the table for the arena. A candidate, Josh Barnett, who would be running in Ward 8 to possibly succeed Diana Howman, said if he's elected, he'll bring a proposal to the committee of the whole, directing staff to begin looking for someone to buy the arena from the city. Do you sense there's actually realistic interest on the council to sell the arena if a buyer could be found?
If a buyer could be found, depending on what they want to do with it, sure. I think that that's very unlikely, and especially a buyer who would come in and do something that was profitable, that was helpful for our downtown and for our community. That'd be, if that happened, that would be fine. It would be, I don't think, though, that that's likely. Can we try? Sure. We can send out an RFP. And let's move forward, a request for proposals, I'm sorry, RFP, that's the acronym, and see what happens. But my guess is we're, for better and worse, we're in this for the long haul with the arena. And we have to do what we can to try to make it work as well as it can, to have it continue to be an asset, an economic asset in our community, as well as a serious cost.
Well, you mentioned it a few moments ago, and I'll circle back to it. The city of Bloomington has a 5-year contract with Venue Works. It's technically through 2021, although the city can exit that contract without cause after 3 years, so that would be
right.
2019. Do you think the city should do that, find a different manager?
Well, I think the jury is still out on that. I'd like to see what happens over the next even 6 to 9 months, and then we'll take an additional assessment of that, see what additional efforts they have. I think one thing that should be explored would be centralized booking. And I mentioned that at our meeting a week ago from yesterday, and that a centralized booking with the Coliseum and the BCPA, why do, there's some duplication there. And is there any reason why we can't centralize that or perhaps automate, much of that? And so I think those are options that we need to consider before we really make a decision on whether or not Venue Works is the long-term partner that we want to have managing the Coliseum.
Mayor Renner, thanks again for your time on Sound Ideas.
Thank you, Ryan.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after the regular and special council meetings. Next week, we'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Coos. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care, exclusive providers of Restore Therapy. Restore Therapy, where your rehab and independence mean more. On the web at heritageofcare.com/restore. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. It started with the hashtag MeToo. Now, after the sexual assault allegations that have put Judge Brett Kavanaugh's once seemingly inevitable Supreme Court confirmation in jeopardy, there's a new social media movement that's empowering survivors of sexual assault and abuse. The hashtag #WhyIDidn'tReport came after President Trump questioned in a tweet why Christine Blasey Ford never reported her alleged abuse to law enforcement 36 years ago. Gabe Kripe at the YWCA McLean County Stepping Stones program tells GLT's Eric Stock about how the latest campaign is changing changing the way we talk about sexual violence.
As we're navigating these really difficult conversations and while we're talking about these hot button issues, there's people in our community that that are affected by these issues, that are hurt by these issues, and that are really still healing from some of the trauma caused by these issues. That our message is to survivors is that, you know, we're here for you, that we support you, and that if you're not feeling supported by your friends and family, we hope that you know that you can turn to Stepping Stones, you can turn to the YWCA, and that there's people in your community who want to support you and help you connect to whatever resources it is that you need.
Since the Why I Didn't Report movement became a thing, similar to the Me Too movement when that started last year, many women, some men, took to social media to explain why they had kept quiet about the allegations, often centered around they didn't think anyone would believe them, they were humiliated, they blamed themselves. Based on the experiences that you hear from your clients, what are some of the leading reasons why victims, women or men, boys or girls, didn't report what happened to them?
Yeah, a lot of the same stuff that you just mentioned. I would encourage folks, if they have questions about and that's something that they think about, oh, why wouldn't somebody report, or why would somebody wait that long to report? I would encourage them to, you know, jump on whatever social media they use, enter in that hashtag of why I didn't report, and really hear directly from survivors on why they didn't report. The things that we hear are, feelings of guilt and shame, feeling like they played a role in their assault, or that if they come forward with this, that people will view them as guilty, which is something that we do see a lot. We hear from people that the person who assaulted them was somebody that they know and somebody that they trust. Maybe it was somebody that they're going to have future interactions with, and they don't want to go through that process.
The challenge in having this conversation in this place and time is that it is entrenched in a very highly politicized situation, maybe one of the biggest political battles in our generation right now. For those who are coming out and explaining why they didn't report, how do you feel that it's helping them in the healing process, or is it?
I think it's different for everyone. I think we see folks who are really empowered by the Me Too movement, by the Why I Didn't Report hashtag, by hearing other people's stories. We certainly see people finding comfort in their community and recognizing that this is something their community cares about. This is something that other people in their community are dealing with. We certainly see that. I think we do see some folks who, like I said, when it's super prevalent, when it's all over social media and all over the news, that can be difficult for people to, you know, log into social media and expect to see posts about cats and YouTube videos and sports and all that, and then maybe be confronted with something that they're not quite ready to think about at that time.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock. We are speaking with Gabe Kripe, the Director of Community Outreach for the YWCA of McLean County Stepping Stones Program. One sidebar issue in relation to this particular case they're referring to, Brett Kavanaugh's possible confirmation to the Supreme Court. Dozens of women came out in support of Judge Kavanaugh hours after the allegations were first detailed. A similar thing happened after Tom Brokaw was accused of sexually harassing female colleagues during his time at NBC. Now, it's clear what the intent of these letters and messages were, but how do they contribute to the conversation when someone might say, okay, they were the perfect gentleman around me. Does that mean that these allegations must be false?
Yeah, it certainly does not. I think, you know, having done this work for a little bit now, you know, what we're taught and what I've come to realize is that the person who has the ability to sexually assault someone and to offend someone is not typically what is portrayed in the media. It's not typically what's portrayed on Law and Order SVU. And a lot of times it is someone that we know, someone that we trust, somebody that by all other accounts is a likable person. And so, you know, for other folks to come out and say, well, you know, this person didn't do this to me, or they treated me this way, while, you know, that might be valid and that might be true, that doesn't discount the fact that other people have had different experiences with that person and other people are voicing those experiences, and that we definitely need to listen to them as well.
Now, we are all familiar with the Duke lacrosse case, mm-hmm. as I'm sure you are.
Yeah.
Three students accused of raping a female student in 2006. The faces of these three young men were splashed on media all over the country, a case that was later dropped. It mm-hmm. was considered a case of an overzealous prosecution. And that case has now found its way into the narrative 12 years later, sure. as some are saying, we can't rush to judgment and presume guilt without corroborating evidence. How can we juggle both not rushing to judgment while still giving survivors the comfort and support they need?
Yeah, there's a few things that I would say to that. One is that false reporting gets made out to be this epidemic, this thing that is happening all over the place, this thing that people, specifically boys and men, need to be very, very worried about. And the reality is that false reporting does not happen very often. Some estimates, the most reliable research we have has that at about 2 to 8%. Some studies having it at 2, one study having it at 8, and then a couple others having it between 2 and 5. And so this idea that this is something that happens, this myth, another piece of research says that that the average college student believes that 50% of reports of sexual assault are false. And so that's alarming. Obviously, those two statistics don't coincide. And so there's this myth that that's something that men need to be worried about, that that's something that men need to be worried about. And that's not the case. In actuality, men are more likely to be the victims of sexual assault than they are to be the victims of a false report of sexual assault. And so I think that's something that we need to keep in mind as we contextualize the conversation.
And in our final moments with Gabe Kripe from YWCA Stepping Stones, how do you view the genesis of the Me Too movement in, say, 10 to 20 years, based on how the conversation has already changed in just the last year or so? What might its legacy be?
Yeah, you know, I hope when we look back on this time period that we look back on it really as a time where people became aware. And so as we're in this, you know, with the hashtag now being why I didn't report, and we're looking back on the Me Too hashtag and some of the other stuff that has been prevalent, like the Brock Turner case, the kid from Stanford, that stuff that makes headline news, I feel like at this point where we're at now, you know, folks maybe 2 or 3 years ago might have said, like, I haven't thought about these issues. I haven't had the opportunity to work through these issues. I haven't had the opportunity to hear women's perspectives or, you know, whatever the person's reasoning for not quite being on board or not quite understanding is, that right now we're in a moment that you have a wonderful opportunity for that. You have a really good opportunity to just jump online and search a hashtag and get answers to some of the questions that you might have. You have an opportunity to hear people's experiences. You have an opportunity to really listen and soak in that information. And so I hope that when we look, 10, 20 years down the road at this time period, that the folks who, you know, are alive now would look back on this moment and say, like, that is when I understood. That's when I took the time to educate myself. And that's when I really decided that I'm going to support survivors, that I'm going to work to create a community that is safe for survivors of sexual assault, and that this is kind of that time period where that education happens.
Kripe says he hopes the Me Too and Why I Didn't Report social media movements will spark a conversation so we can better understand each other as a community. He spoke to GLT's Eric Stock.
Your support keeps us going, so contribute anytime at WGLT.org.
Hi, I'm Don Gagne. The 2018 midterm elections will be one of this year's biggest stories as voters head to the polls, and we'll be reporting as the results come in. While you'll be counting on all of us here to provide you with the answers and analysis you need, we'll be counting on you to support that work. So help us help you.
Please contribute now at WGLT.org, and thank you. Support for GLT comes from Connect Transit. Get connected with Connect Transit 7 days a week. Riders can track buses in real time with the Connect Transit app for Android or iPhone. Information at connect-transit.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Jessica Lynn is an advocate and activist for the transgender community. She's a Kinsey Institute Global Ambassador with Indiana University and a Stonewall School role model, to name a few distinctions. GLT's Mary Cullen spoke with Lynn ahead of her speaker series presentation at Illinois State University tomorrow night.
Let's talk about your journey as a transgender woman. How old were you when your transition began?
45 years old. I did not begin my transition, but I knew at the age of about 4.
Were you in a supportive environment as a child, or is there a story behind there?
I was born in Southern California in Los Angeles area. I had 4 brothers and an older sister. And I was born in 1965. I'm 53 years old. And it was not something I knew about, understood, and it was just not something I had ever heard about, if that makes sense to you. But I knew at the age of about 4 and a half years old that I desperately, desperately wanted to be a girl, and I didn't understand it, you know. So I would kept it hidden, and I did things to cope. Whatever I did, I obsessed with. And so when I'm a young child, my mom was a religious woman, and she said, Jeff, if you pray hard enough, God will move mountains. So I was at my hands and knees every single night begging God at 4 or 5 years old to turn me into a girl, you know, crying myself to sleep night after night after night, not understanding it, just wanting to be a girl. It just didn't make sense to me. So to stop the thinking of it constantly, I would start doing things. I collected insects. I collected bugs. I collected stamps. I started oil painting. So it was a coping mechanism. It's very, very common in the older LGBT community because we grew up in a time where it was no such thing, no understanding of it. And when somebody talked about gay, or if you saw a guy on the television wearing a dress, they were ridiculed. They were made fun of. They were driven out of town. And so why would you want to come out and say this? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Then during your life, by the time that you got to 45, what inspired you to or empowered you to really realize your true self?
I ended up, you know, like my presentation when I speak, you'll hear my presentation. What I do is I do a lot of presentations, but my most powerful, powerful presentation is my life story. And it helps students and people and the general people understand that I'm just a normal, everyday person, and people in our community are everyday, normal people. And so I'm going to tell you my life story. And it talks about being a young child, dealing with the coping mechanisms, and what I did to deal with it. So when I finally came out, I ended up becoming a father of 3 children. And finally, at 45 years old, I could not handle it anymore, and finally decided I had to transition at 45 years old. It was do or die.
So how would you say your experiences through your transition led you to become a world-traveling transgender advocate and speaker that you are today?
When I transitioned, I wanted to, go live the stealth life. I wanted to never say I'm a transgender person. I wanted to go become just a woman, live a normal life, find a boyfriend, a husband, and just live that dream life, you know, that some people, Jazz Jennings can do, and a few, Avery Jackson can do, you know, these younger people can do.
Mm-hmm.
But if you know anything about my story, and what I'll get into detail is, I'm a father of 3, and I had a full legal physical custody of all 3 children here in California. I went through a 3-year legal battle, and it was brought up that I was transgender. Their mother tried to throw it at the judge, and the judge did not care and gave me full physical custody of all 3 children. We made arrangements, and I came out to my 2 older boys, and they were fully fine with it. And all she asked is that we wait until my youngest is 12. So we waited till my youngest is 12. I called her and said, it's time we tell him. She said, F you, file a restraining order. And I went through a huge legal battle with the state of Texas. And the state of Texas ordered some major, major stuff on me. And their evaluator came back and said I was the better parent. But in June of 2013, the judge removed all of my parental rights to my youngest child. He took my name off my child's birth certificate. It went all the way up to the Department of Justice, and he said, there's really not much you can do about it. You know, this judge crossed every T, dotted every I, And they said, go start speaking about it.
So what's your overall goal for the Butterfly Project then? I mean, it might have changed from when you started it to now, but today, what do you see it as you're hoping to achieve?
To make the world accept into every shade of gray in the transgender community. In the United States, there's 1.4 million people that identify as trans. That's 1.4 million different people. We're all different. We're all unique. We all have different shades of gray. So we want the whole people to be less discriminatory so that if I come to you and say, okay, I'm a trans woman, who cares, you know? And what we want to do is to have the whole world be more accepting to people in our community. And if I can make a little bit of an effort to help change the world, that's my goal, you know?
Yeah.
And to keep the conversation, part of my conversation, this presentation this year is called The Butterfly Project. And I use a butterfly a lot because it was an escape tool at a young child. And then it's the butterfly effect. Towards the end of my presentation, I ask everybody in the audience to go home and tell at least one member of their family, friends, boyfriend, girlfriend, sister, cousin, aunt, whoever, what they had heard that night, to continue the conversation, to keep it going, to, you know, it's not just 1, 2, 5 people that are changing the world. We all of us, every single one of us, need to continue the conversation to change the world.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen talking with Jessica Lynn, an advocate and activist for the transgender community. After speaking in 18 different countries, what are some of the differing cultural contexts for transgender people?
I have found that England is the most, so far out of my travels, is England is the most accepting country in the world that I have found so far, okay? Not all of England, but most of England, the big cities. It's a very, very diverse community. But you go to Poland, and they are not. It's a fairly conservative government, and people are scared to come out. The government makes it very, very difficult for you to transition there. You know, you have to jump through so many hoops to get a name changed, to get, you know, to go through surgery. They make it, they almost criminalize it, if that makes sense. They haven't, but it's a very, very difficult thing. So about maybe 6, 7, 8 months ago, I spoke at a psychology group on University of Warsaw. And then I was asked to come back to go speak to all these psychologists that are around the area in Warsaw, want to meet with me to help them understand more about the transgender community to help with their clientele. I mean, there's literature everywhere out in the world, but there's just not enough to speak about it in Poland. But India is a fascinating place, and that's actually where I came up with the idea of the Butterfly Project. I spent 3 weeks in India. India just decriminalized homosexuality. So different parts of the world are different understandings, different feelings. And to be honest with you, the most difficult places I've ever been to are the southern part of the United States. I've never had an issue. You know, I've probably given close to 700, 800, 900 lectures in my years doing this. I've never had an issue, but they there really tended to be the most discriminatory that I've met.
So how do you handle those situations?
With humor. I have to. You know, you have to smile. It's much, much easier to smile and to turn it into something positive than to turn it into a negative. And if somebody says something to me, I smile and I turn it around. And it'll make them feel uncomfortable and say, what am I saying this? That's stupid of me. So I go through life. I keep a very, very, very positive outlook. And that's the way it is. It's easier to smile than it is to frown. And, you know, I'm tall. I'm blonde hair. 99% of the people have no idea that I'm transgender, right? I pass very well. But when I walk through an airport, people tend to stare at me. I'm tall. And I was in a thrift store about a year or two ago. And I walk in, and this girl's sitting there staring at me, and she comes walking up, and I'm smiling, you know. She comes walking up. She goes, can I ask you a question, a personal question? You know, I was waiting for, are you transgender? She goes, are you a rock star? She goes, every time you come in here, you have the most badass hair. You know, so I think that people are staring at me for my being transgender, but they're not. They're curious. I stick out. I stand out a little bit more. I hold my head up. I'm proud of who I am. I'm not afraid to tell anybody of who I am.
So, I mean, we're talking now about the surprising and nice sides, but we also know that there continues to be many acts of violence against people in the LGBTQ community. Do you have any fear?
No. Like I said, I'm lucky I pass. When I meet a guy and if I start dating a guy, I am one that will tell a guy first. I started dating a guy once, and about the second or third date, he says, where's your children's father? And I was dumbfounded, and it can be a dangerous situation.
Yeah.
So when I meet a guy and he asks me out, I'm pretty much upfront with him. And that, to me, is the only dangerous situation I can find myself in.
Along those lines, you have children, and it sounds like they're a bit older, but how do you balance the risks that you're taking for the cause and the need to keep both your children and yourself safe?
The one that's with me, you know, that supports me now is Jeffrey, and he's 27 years old. He's my strongest ally. As I said, they took away my parental rights to my youngest child, and I haven't seen him since 10 years old. So I don't stress about that, if that makes sense.
Switching gears a little bit, how do you handle people who may have some hesitation to ask you about your experiences, whether they're unaware of what's considered to be politically correct or they just haven't been around someone who is transgender before?
When somebody hears me speak, they know that I'm an open book. I'm very, very, very approachable. I leave my email address up there, and I said, I am going to come outside of the hall. You know, sometimes I just do classrooms. Sometimes I've flown to Delaware to speak to 10 students. Sometimes I'm in halls of 2,000, 3,000 people, and I will tell them, you know, I will walk outside, and if you want to ask me a personal one-on-one question, I will answer it. If you have an email, if you want to email, there's my email, and I will contact you back, and I will stay on the phone with you, and I'll talk to you. I am extremely approachable.
What would you say your message is for the cisgender community?
That is my main target audience, is the cisgender community, to become more aware and accepting. Most cisgender people in the world, they don't know much about the transgender community, but once they hear somebody, once they meet somebody, it opens their mind up. They say, well, I was going through TSA in Heathrow, and this guy, the TSA agent, a really good-looking guy, David Beckham lookalike, and we started talking, and he goes, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm speaking. What are you speaking about? He closed his window and pulled me aside, and we had a 10-15 minute conversation. He said, what about your children? What if one of them comes to you and says, Dad, I want to be a girl? He goes, I never thought about that. 95% of the students that I speak to will become parents one day. Some of them will have a child will come and say, I'm gay, I'm trans, I'm bi, I'm genderqueer, somewhere in that spectrum, and it's going to open their eyes up a little bit more.
So in your opinion, would you say that society is moving towards acceptance and celebrating the lives and journeys of transgender people?
Absolutely. We have an administration right now. I mean, you can see where I am politically, but we have an administration right now that is going backwards in time, but people are fighting back.
So we talked about your message to cisgender people. What is your message to transgender people?
That don't be ashamed of who you are. Feel comfortable, feel proud wherever you fit in that gender spectrum. The biggest problem, when I came out and transitioned, my local community, there was a few people said, you had to transition this way. You have to wear clothes like this. They criticized me for wearing short skirts and 5-inch stilettos. You know, I used to go to a tanning salon, and I looked halfway decent, and they would criticize me and say, you have to do it this way, you have to do it this way. But there is no specific way to transition. I want the transgender community to transition the way they want to transition. So if you say, I want to be a boy, you don't have to follow any rules. There are rules that you have to follow to have surgeries and that specific things to be on hormones and all that. But for me to say you have to dress like this, you have to wear this kind of clothing, you have to wear your hair like this, bullshit. You have to be who you are. And that's my biggest advice to people is feel comfortable and transition as fast as you feel comfortable doing it.
Jessica Lynn is speaking as part of Illinois State University's speaker series on September 26th at 5 p.m. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Jessica.
Thank you so much. That was fun.
I'm Mary Cullen.
Transgender advocate and activist Jessica Lynn speaks at ISU at 5 p.m. Wednesday night. That talk is part of the speaker series at ISU and Queer Talks. It's free and open to the public. This is Sound Ideas. This is Sound Ideas. For a local poet, the concerts he attended over the decades have added up to more than T-shirts and hazy recollections. Laura Kennedy has more.
As a young man attending concerts in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, scholar and poet Tim Hunt had little idea at the time that those performances would one day inspire a collection of poetry. The new work is called Ticket Stubs and Liner Notes. It visits the soundtrack of the baby boom generation, reaching back to remember the music, the innocence, and the experiences that still linger on the fringe of memory. Hunt says he mostly wrote these poems just in the past few years, using the prism of his memories to hear traces of the faraway notes.
And the idea was to try to evoke something of the difference between what it was like to listen to these people early on when you're just kind of naive and into the music, and sort of what it seems like in retrospect.
So the way you hear the music now is much different than when you heard it as a youth?
The way I remember things is different. Let's say I heard Chuck Berry in a divey bar outside of Ithaca, New York, when I was a college student.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
How exciting.
Yes, he led us through a rousing rendition of My Ding-a-Ling. As he said, the ladies have their part, the men have their part. But at the time, I didn't really realize that he'd been burned so much by concert promoters that he would only play after somebody paid him cash up front. And, you know, he would be sort of many places restricted to his own car. So the last line of the poem is Chuck going back out to his Cadillac shack. At the time, it never occurred to me the racial dynamics, even in the late 1960s, for a performer like Berry. Of course, thinking back on it now, it does. So the poem sort of plays that retrospection against that naivete.
So let's hear the poem that you wrote about Chuck Berry.
So this is called My Ding-a-Ling. Chuck Berry at the Roadhouse, Ithaca, New York, November 1970. No matter the night, Chuck will be good, ringing Johnny just like a bell and duck walking the stage as if he's Groucho Marx with a guitar being played by Nureyev. So what if the dance floor kids think he's ripping off the Rolling Stones and the frat boy cover band trying to back him is chair square and got no flair? The Cadillac out back is all his, all fins and two-tone, and not au fait pink. And tonight he'll double his entendre with some sweet 16 Queenie wannabe Nabilene Nadine. But first, he must teach us all the lesson of My Ding-a-Ling, lining it out to cue the girls for their part, my, cueing us for ours, ding-a-ling. Oh, yes, yes, this is the Church of Chuck, and we want to play with our ding-a-ling. And while we do, Daddy Chuck will get all the real thing, playing it good like Johnny B. Good, pumping like an old steam drill out back in his Cadillac shack.
Thank you for reading that, Tim.
Oh, you're welcome.
Really appreciate that.
Thanks for giving me the chance.
It seems like this would really appeal to the baby boomers. But do you see that there might be some cross-generational appeal with these poems, even though we're talking about artists that many young people today are not familiar with?
Yes. My last semester of teaching, I mentioned Chuck Berry in passing, and no one had heard of him.
At all?
At all.
And this was like maybe a few years ago?
December of 2016, yes. So, yes, that's a problem. So as the book comes out, it'll come out with a companion website.
To get educated.
Yeah. So the entry for Chuck Berry will include a YouTube clip of Chuck duck walking, a rendition of My Ding-a-Ling, and a reading of the poem, that sort of thing.
Music is a very personal thing. It can mean different things to different people, very personal things. What can people find in your poems that will resonate with them, that will strike the right note?
Well, if they're a baby boomer, we'll go back to your first point. I'm hoping maybe the poems give them a chance to reimagine what the music was like for them at the time, but also how they can now see it from a different angle with, shall we say, a decade or two of additional experience or awareness. And for, let's say, the ISU student audience, if any of those folks were likely to read the poems, it might give them a sense of how we related to music in that era through a very different media landscape than theirs.
Because nowadays we're relating to music in a very immediate way through streaming, through right. iTunes and that sort of thing. And with you guys, you put a nickel in the jukebox or you have to go to a concert and maybe you're lucky you can hear something on the radio.
Right.
Wasn't so readily available.
No, it wasn't. If you might have some albums or some 45s, but it was a relatively limited library. And when I was in high school, this goes way, way back, you know, you would drive around in your car hoping to hear a song because the car radio was the one place where you could really hear your music because at home, your parents maybe didn't want you playing, let's say, the Jefferson Airplane.
So was it music that led you to poetry?
Not necessarily, but I think they are sort of twinned in my head. I never wanted to be a songwriter. I never really aspired to that. So poetry and songwriting are different, but I want the poems in this collection to have something like the immediacy of a song.
You have one of the icons of the late 60s as an inspiration for one of your poems, and it's Janis Joplin. Could you read that Janis Joplin poem for us?
This is called Janis Joplin Plays the Fraternity Brothers. The Armory, Cornell, May 3rd, 1969. The boy, chosen as envoy already, seems to know his brass-buttoned blazer, regulation cut, tailored just for him, is not impressing the girl who is not a girl, but a hot mama who is a girl who is not. But he has been chosen and squares his shoulders before her silk bell-bottoms and silk colors of the blouse that jiggle as she sings and the hat with feathers. And offering the small box with its bow, he recites his lines. Miss Joplin, the brothers of Cornell, present you with the small token of our esteem. And Janis opens the gift, then dangles the mink bra for us to admire, a little girl on Christmas morning posing for Daddy. And because it is her role to be the girl who is abroad, and this her show, she broadens the drawl, smiling out as if we are all in on the joke. But honey, the fur's on the wrong side.
Is there a poem that in particular that you would love to leave to read live that you really think an audience would really get into?
Sure. Let's try one of the book is divided into sets like a concert would be. And so there's an encore. So I'll read a poem from the encore. In my youth, one talked about guitar gods. So Eric Clapton was God. You've heard that phrase.
Oh, yeah.
And there were a number of guitar gods. And one time I was joking with a guy on a job interview and who played guitar, and we started naming guitar players, and we started trying to figure out where they belong in the Bible of guitar players. So this poem sort of plays from that. Well, this is called Testaments. It is said that Eric Clapton is God, and I do in part believe in double-crossing time and sweet wine. I'll be free and crossroads, but in my heart of hearts I know he is only a prophet. Among prophets are perhaps one of the gods in the temple of Gibson, of Fender, where the tubes of endless stacks of Marshall amps hum the fundamental om. Oh, there are many gods in the god who is twang, and I have listened deep into the sacred text, searching for the absolute harmonic of E strings high and low, the soul of calloused thumb, of pick, of glass bottle slide against open-tuned strings, the speaking in tongues of sound in Elmore, James, and Robert Johnson. The chicken-picked flurries of the Lonnie, who is Mac, the absolute command of time of the Charlie, who is Christian. Oh, so many gods in God, but let us agree on some things if we can. T-Bone Walker is Isaiah, prophesying against mere sweet swing. And Link Ray, I tell you, truly is John the Baptist. And Clarence White, a son of God, taken too soon. And if you would deny even these truths, I do believe we can agree Keith Richards is the Antichrist. And we worship him, too.
I love the name check of Charlie Christian in there.
Yeah, well, and if your listeners don't know the guitar player Clarence White, he is one of my gods, and I encourage them all to check out Clarence.
That's poet and scholar Tim Hunt. His new collection, Ticket Stubs and Liner Notes, has won the 2018 Main Street Rag Poetry Book Award. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Tim Hunt's book will be released in November. In the meantime, you can hear another poem from Ticket Stubs and Liner Notes right now at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, our websites where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, with help today from Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, and Laura Kennedy. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. You can also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. And if you haven't noticed, this is week one of the GLT Fund Drive. Our goal is to raise $25,000 for listener support just 7 days. We're determined to do it without interrupting programs to ask for your help. It's the kind of fundraising that respects the reasons you depend on GLT. We won't take time away from the news and conversations that are important to you. Show us this can work. Help pay for Sound Ideas. Help us meet the goal. Renew your support or make your first contribution now. WGLT.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.